and health care. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Defeated Tea Party Senate candidate Christine O'Donnell is refuting claims that she misused campaign funds in her Delaware race. She told ABC's Good Morning America that reports of a federal investigation against her are politically motivated, citing Vice President Joe Biden as one of the possible perpetrators of unfounded rumors. O'Donnell says neither she nor her campaign was informed of a federal probe. Here's an update from Wall Street. Dow Jones Industrial Average falling, now 24 points down at 11,561. NASDAQ Composite Index down 4 points at 2,663. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
As you make your year-end giving decisions, please consider a gift to WILL. Listener support is the heart and soul of this station, and your gift will help pay for the programs you rely on next year. You can make a contribution online now at willpledge.org, or mail a check to Friends of WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series featuring our most entertaining interviews of the year with Jay-Z. He'll talk about writing his most famous songs and his first rhymes when he was 9.
They were kind of advanced for a young kid. Like, I'm the king of hip-hop, the renewed like the Reebok, the key in the lock with words so provocative as long as I live.
Jay-Z on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. The 10th parallel is a line that runs around the globe 700 miles north of the equator. Half of the world's Muslims live along this line, as well as 60% of the world's Christians. Our guest, Liza Griswold, has spent the past 7 years traveling along this line, visiting places like Sudan, Somalia, Nigeria, Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, all places where there's been conflict between Christians and Muslims. And she says that she was really interested in trying to get a better understanding of this conflict, having heard a lot of explanations, including that explanation that says, well, what we have here is a fundamental clash of civilizations between the Christian world and the Islamic world. So she says she really wanted to go to the place where this conflict was actually happening to see if perhaps she could get a better, more nuanced understanding of what was going on there. And the result of all of this travel and all of this writing has been gathered together in a book recently published by Farrar Straus Giroux. The title of the book is The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. And with us this morning to talk about the book is Liza Griswold. Her journalism has appeared in a number of places, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, and Harper's, among other publications. She was a 2007 Nieman Fellow at Harvard. She's won some awards for her work. Also, she's a poet. A collection of her poems, Wide Awake Field, was published in 2007. And Liza Griswold, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We appreciate it. And just as a way of a bit of background on you, I'm sure you end up having to talk about this in interviews, but I would say that your interest in matters of faith, this has to be something that you come by honestly, as your dad is a bishop of the Episcopal Church. In fact, he was at one time the presiding bishop. He was the top guy of the Episcopal Church.
That's correct. That's correct. He retired about 3 years ago from the position. And being presiding bishop means being the head of the Episcopal Church in the United States, which has about 2 million members.
And he was at one time the bishop of Chicago. Did you grow up in Chicago?
I moved to Chicago when I was 12, and my father went from being a local parish priest in a Philadelphia suburb to being the bishop of an urban core, really, an urban area. And so when he made that transition, my family moved along with him.
Okay. Well, to go to the subject of the 10th parallel, we know that religious conflict, or maybe better to say conflict that has religious dimensions, has been a fact of maybe human existence for a long time on a sort of a regional or local basis. Now, it's something that we're thinking about and talking about a lot now, and not just conflict between Muslims and Christians, but it does seem to be something that we hear about more and more. So I suppose that invites the question, well, is this something that for some reason is more intense than it has been in the past, or is it just because it's seems so much a part of what's going on in the world now that it just seems that way?
Well, it's a complicated answer to a really important question, because the truth is that when we see Islam and Christianity in terms of two global monoliths, and we ask, are these two engaged in a new kind of confrontation, or is that confrontation newly bloody, that answer is probably no, right? That answer on a broad scale is probably, you know what, we're looking at levels that are so oversimplified and generalized that they lose their meaning. When we look at ideologies that are in competition, we certainly do see Islam and Christianity in greater confrontation, in part because of the very forces of globalization that make it possible for us to hear about what's happening very far away. Those are the same. These fights over the airwaves, these fights over ideas, these are where the battleground actually lies. Because when you get to the ground and you see what's happening between Christians and Muslims, like I did, spending 7 years traveling along this fault line where the two religions meet, what you actually see on the ground happening is much more vast and varied. There's a large presence of coexistence and peaceful coexistence that's more than 1,000 years old. There are also pockets of conflict that are becoming more pronounced. So the answer is both, and usually a varied, varied response across the spectrum.
Mm. Well, that I guess it also invites a question. I want to invite you to talk about something that you say that you really learned here, that conflict over right and wrong and what's the way to live and who speaks for God is maybe particularly intense, maybe even more intense, not between faiths, but within them, as people within a particular faith community, whether that be Christian or Hindu or Muslim or what have you, people within that community are fighting with one another about who gets to speak for God.
That's exactly right. The most overlooked religious clashes and religious struggles of our time are those struggles inside of religions. And it's really those questions that are forming the future of any respective faith. You know, and we certainly see, you know, if we take that within a Christian context for a second, because I grew up as the child of a progressive Christian leader who, you know, a few years ago, the Episcopal Church in the United States elected its first openly homosexual bishop. Gene Robinson is the Bishop of New Hampshire. When my father, in his capacity as presiding bishop, went to consecrate Bishop Robinson, which means it's basically the act by which a man or a woman is made a bishop, my father had to wear a bulletproof vest underneath his vestments. The understanding wasn't that some kind of Muslim terrorist was going to come leaping out of the audience, but that a fellow Christian, somebody who shared his understanding, was going to take issue with homosexuality and actually endanger my father's life. And that's one of those tectonic plates shifting inside of religions between, you know, progressives and conservatives over who's a true believer and who's not within Christianity. We certainly see the same trends in Islam between those who believe that Islam can and needs to be reinterpreted according to the 21st century social mores and those who believe that that kind of interpretation is haram or forbidden. At the same time within Islam, we see sectarian differences, which is kind of like the differences between, you know, Presbyterians and Unitarians on crack, you know, this kind of very pronounced borders between the two. And just to name a few for listeners, we would be looking at the differences between Sunnis and Sufis and the Shia, to name just three of the groups within Islam who have different interpretations of what it means to be a Muslim today. So these are the kind of divisions in competition with each other that truly form the future of our world's religions.
Well, I think this is a fascinating and very important point, and something that people really need to pay attention to. And I think, at least as far as Christianity is concerned, there hasn't been enough, there has been some, but maybe it hasn't been enough written about the fact that where's the great growth in Christianity? Well, it's in the places, some of the places that you visited, and in Latin America. It's in the developing world. And if you say, well, where is the future of Christianity? Some people would say it's in Africa, and that there is a lot of conflict and consternation around some core issues, and I think it's really interesting, and I think it's an overlooked story.
Yeah, it's absolutely an overlooked story. It doesn't lend itself to sound bites quite as easily. It's certainly not as sexy. And, you know, as a member of media, I take full responsibility, but we overlook stories that don't forward trends we're already hearing about. You know, so to say, hang on a second, let's look at the confrontation within Christianity. You know, you've got to have a pretty long leash from an editor or a news publication to be able to do that. And I was lucky to have that both from my incredible editorial team at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, where I worked with two editors, as well as from, you know, the bipartisan think tank New America, which was funding a lot of my research. So I had a pretty broad mandate to go out and see what was actually happening on the ground without coming back with some kind of overblown, sexy seller thesis that had to go on the front cover of a magazine in terms that were too simple to actually really explain the situation.
This would be a good opportunity for me to reintroduce the guest, and also I have a caller here we'll get to. We're talking this morning with Eliza Griswold. She is a fellow at the New America Foundation. She's a journalist. Her work has appeared in many places, The Atlantic, New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, Harper's. She's the author of the book, fairly recently published. It's titled The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and it is indeed the result of a lot of journalism that she's done along this in this geographic area, the 10th parallel, but particularly in places that I named. It's in Sudan, in Nigeria, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, that are right along, pretty close along that line, and places where there has been, in fairly recent times, some very serious conflict between Christians and Muslims. So questions welcome. We have somebody right here lined up and ready to go, and we'll go there. This is Champagne, and the caller is on our line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have two questions that I'd like you to talk about, or two areas. One is recently in the news, in the past few days, literally, there's been talk of some Islamic, quote, terrorist group in northern Nigeria that's been attacking various villages. And there was some talk about them driving through a city on motorcycles and shooting, etc. I know the Nigerian Christian-Muslim conflict dates back all the way to the Nigerian Civil War between the northern Muslims and the southern Christians. So there's a lot there to talk about. I'd be interested to hear what you found in your travels. The other area is has to do with Thailand. I know that's in theory not your area, but since you were in Malaysia, I figure you can maybe talk a little about this. And this isn't a Muslim Christian, but Muslim Buddhist in southern Thailand, where there's been a lot of Muslim attacks on Buddhist monks, on Buddhist communities. This is a long-standing conflict which is erupting in recent years to the extent that, I'll let you to talk about what to the extent of. So do those questions make sense? And
they make absolutely perfect sense, and both are conflicts I've actually reported on firsthand. And they're very important questions about what's going on basically at grassroots levels between what look like, on the surface, small groups of militants who are rising up against the state and against fellow citizens, saying, you know, in the name of Islam, we are going to defend ourselves against the West or against the state. So in Nigeria, that group, the name that we're hearing a lot these days is called Boko Haram, which means Western education forbidden, essentially. More than 23 million Muslim, young Muslims, mostly boys, in Nigeria have absolutely no form of schooling besides something called Al-Majri education. Al-Majri education is essentially a madrasa form, which means they go to, we hear that, that's a word we're familiar with from Afghanistan and Pakistan a bit. What it means is that these kids have historically traveled from their hometowns to farms, essentially, where they work with different Muslim teachers, and the schools are free. These Al-Majri schools have historically been free, and in exchange for essentially learning the Quran by heart and learning some math and science and whatever each local curriculum is, the kids work on the farm to pay back. So the school's free, but they pay for it by labor. What's happened, and this is one of the areas in the book in which you can see climate change explicitly tied to religion, which is a very unexpected but actually a worsening trend, especially along the 10th parallel. What happens is in the northern Nigeria, where most of these Muslim schools used to be, the land is no longer viable for farming. It's drying out. It's what's called desertification. It's becoming desert, essentially. And so these malams, these Muslim teachers, are moving south, and they move to the edge of major cities. They move to slums, essentially. And in the slums, they have a different way of paying for getting the kids to pay for school, and that's begging. So what happens is you have, again, we're talking about more than 20 million young boys, essentially, having no form of education. Now they're out there begging on the streets. And what happens, unfortunately, is that they become a very ready army in the service of whatever thug or politician wants to hire them. So in Nigeria, you know, elections are notoriously bloody, and that happens that, like, a local politician will want to win a certain election, and so he'll go to one of these malams, one of these religious teachers who has maybe, you know, 1,000 students, and say, hey, guess what? I'll pay you $2,000. You give me your kids for the day of the election and tell them to let loose and wreak havoc on this community so that, you know, I can win in election day violence. So Boko Haram, this group that sometimes calls itself, is certainly allied with a group called the Taliban in Nigeria. These guys have adopted this stance that they are kind of part of this global militant Islamic movement. They really are not. They're a local group of thugs who are totally uneducated, and they're using their interpretation of Islam to essentially terrorize local people in the north, Christians and Muslims alike, who don't follow their strict interpretation of Islam, but they're totally uneducated. So we're not looking at kind of, well, we understand what the Quran says and we're living according to it. Not at all. We're looking at, well, we want to own access to the local fuel lines, and so we're going to use Islam to exploit our power over it. It's a notoriously violent group. They've come into a lot of conflict with local governments, especially in a town called Maiduguri, in a place called Borno State, which is one of the 12 states in northern Nigeria under Sharia or Islamic law. You know, pretty recently, a bunch of these guys orchestrated a jailbreak. Are they dangerous to us? That's a question. We don't really know yet. Are they traveling to Yemen to learn how to take their local tactics to a more global fight? There is some evidence of that. Whether they and how they could blow back directly on us, again, that's an open question. But this is why we need to address at the very most basic levels education, especially in Nigeria and a lot of West Africa, because this is one of the most pronounced problems. I myself was attacked and actually almost killed by a group of these kids. And when I say kids, I mean really I'm talking up through quite men, really, from the ages of 18 to about 35. I was in a market on a Friday prayer day. On the morning of a Friday prayer, I was with a photographer. Actually, just wrote about this in Outside Magazine. But the photographer, another Western guy, an Irishman, Seamus Murphy was taking pictures of this local group and took pictures of the wrong guys. And about a crowd of at least 100 men unsheathed what northern Nigerians call cutlasses, which are swords, essentially they're machetes, and attacked our car, almost killed our translator, and were determined to kill us. But thanks to the intervention of actually one of their own teachers and a local policeman, we were able to escape. So Boko Haram, these Nigerian militant groups, I know pretty well. And that's the kind of the way in which we see a local problem and think, you know, this is a way in which we could help address this so it doesn't go global on us. Similarly, when we look east, we look to Thailand. Actually, this same area is right along the 10th parallel. I don't write about it in my book, The 10th Parallel, because it is a Buddhist-Muslim conflict, and I really wanted to look at Christianity and Islam, but I have been there. I have been to Naratiwat and Patani, the towns where this conflict is being waged, and looked firsthand at what's going on. And you're exactly right. What we see here is Muslims killing Buddhist monks, and that is a pretty unusual spectacle for us in the West. Again, you know, it's a fight of thuggery, using religion as a mask for what's really going on. These guys understand themselves to be oppressed, an oppressed Muslim minority at the edge of a Buddhist majority. And the Buddhist state in Thailand can be pretty corrupt. And these guys feel that they've been left out of political power and education, scholarships, jobs for a very long time. And so they've started to fight back against their own government. Again, this is a local conflict. Where we see it problematic, where we see it go global, is when this kind of thing starts to provide a safe haven for militants. When people from the outside come in, they start teaching, like, how to make car bombs, how to make, you know, other kinds of roadside bombs. And then we start to see a different pattern emerging, and that's what we need to watch for in Thailand today. But what I would say, above all, before we go thinking, you know, Al-Qaeda is in northern Nigeria or in southern Thailand, we need to look at the social problems that really provide the most ready fuel to these small-scale Islamic uprisings. And when we look at those social problems, we actually can help make a difference and help states make a difference. And that would be the key to defusing some of these time bombs before they come back and explode in our own faces.
Thank you.
All right. That I think these two cases illustrate something that people do say, observations that have been made, and I don't know how much attention that people pay to those people who say, now look, you have to look at what's going on in particular places, and that we have places where there are conflicts that seem to have religious dimension, where religion is part of people's identity, but what people are fighting about is some very concrete things other than religion, like who gets whatever valuables there are to be had, who gets to control natural resources, who has the power within the society.
Exactly.
And that one should be very careful simply to say, oh, well, that's simply religious conflict, and you know that kind of thing has been going on forever, and it's the casual thoughtless analysis that says, these people in this place X, oh, you know, they've been fighting each other for forever, and they're going to go on forever. And it completely ignores the context.
Exactly right. So there are two dangers, right? One is looking at these local conflicts and being like, oh, they've been going on forever, don't pay any attention. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's like, oh, Jesus, Al-Qaeda is springing up all over the world, and man, look, they're in Thailand, they're in Nigeria, we better just go to war against Islam, right? Because that would be the other end of that not enough nuanced approach to what's going on. You know, I never saw, in 7 years of reporting this book, I never saw a conflict that didn't have a worldly trigger or a secular trigger, you know, whether that was land, oil, water, or even crops of chocolate in Indonesia. The causes of these conflicts are always interwoven between, you know, political economy and religion, but both do play a part. And so no two places are the same. At the same time, there are trends that we need to watch with really the failure of states. Weak states fail failing states, it's these places in which religious identity tends to bear more of a role and more of a violent role than it does in places where people have more equitable access to goods and services. So what we want to do when people say, well, what can we do? We can begin to address some of that iniquity, get behind grassroots organizations, faith-based organizations that are already reaching out to the needs of their own people, because it's that kind of rage at having nothing, that rage at divisions that become most violent. And then out of that, once a safe haven is established in the name of a particular religion, particularly when it comes to Islam these days, that does tend to draw a global jihadi presence, and that is what absolutely is a danger to us.
Our guest in this hour of focus is journalist Eliza Griswold. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation. She has written for a number of different publications, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, and Harper's, among others. And she is the author of the recent book, The Tenth Parallel. The subtitle is Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam, published by Ferrer, Straus, and Giroux. And sort of has it takes as its structural device the fact that there is this line, the 10th parallel, that runs around the globe. And as I said at the beginning, this is a line that runs around the globe at 700 miles north of the equator, and half of the world's Muslims live along this line, also 60% of the world's Christians. And so we're talking about places here like Sudan, Somalia, Nigeria, Indonesia, Malaysia, the Philippines, and these are all places where there has been conflict between Christians and Muslims. And Eliza Griswold explains that she was really interested in going to these places and trying to get a better understanding about what was going on. And that's the whole idea behind the book, and so you can look for it if you want to read in greater detail. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sure that it is the case that there are places around the world where people of different faiths, and Muslims and Christians particularly, manage to live together just fine. Is there something about this particular region that, though, facilitates conflict, or does it again have to go back to this way of looking at things? And say, well, you've got to look at one place and just what's going on in that one place, and be careful about overgeneralizing.
Well, you know, it's important to. It's the answer to both. Do you know? I mean, we cannot simply see everything is so isolated that we can't draw trends from it. At the same time, we can't look from 30,000 feet and think we understand exactly what's going on the ground, which is why, you know, essentially I began this knowing that, you know, 4 out of 5 of the world's 1.3 billion Muslims are not Arabs. They don't live in the Middle East. They live in Africa, and they live in Asia. And I wanted to go to where on the ground they practically meet about half of the world's 2 billion Christians, to see what really is happening across cultures and continents in fights over land, politics, water and oil, as I said, especially in Sudan. You know, I mean, one place in which we have to pay particular attention right now is Sudan. Sudan is divided between the north and south on the 10th parallel. And I'll keep this brief. If you would like to read more about how this happened, you know, I would refer you to the book, because it's a 100-year story. But essentially, the British divided Sudan in two on this line of latitude between an Arab, predominantly Muslim north, and what was then Christian south, Christian and actually non-Muslim south, because Christianity was just arriving at the hands of European missionaries. So what happened essentially when the British divided North and South is that North became the place where the colonial power put its infrastructure. And today, that's certainly true. The result of this divide along the 10th parallel has been more than 40 years of civil war and the death of more than 2 million people. So the South has historically been pretty beat up on by the North, a trend that definitely worsened after the discovery of oil in the South. But it was the Northern government that had the power to essentially wage the modern world's bloodiest jihad against its own people, Christians and Muslims alike, who live in the south of the country. Fast forward to today. Right now what's going on is that the South should have the right to vote in a referendum on January 9th of 2011, so in the next few months, over its right to be independent, to become an independent country for the first time in history. Now, what does that mean to us? That is extraordinarily, it's a powder keg, because what we may see is that if this doesn't come off all right, if Southern Sudan doesn't establish itself as a viable country, we're definitely looking at what could be the bloodiest conflict in the next decade of African life. That makes Congo just pale in comparison to what could happen if Southern Sudan draws its neighbors into a massive war with its own north over who has the right to its oil wealth primarily. So that's one of those situations in which we really need to look at local conditions. But, you know, how are local and global tied together? Well, look at that north. You know, Osama bin Laden found safe haven in northern Sudan during the 90s when no other country would have him. So it was there that he hatched a lot of his rhetoric about global ideology and global jihad that he then took to Afghanistan. So we really need to pay attention to what happens when these states have internal trouble, and how does that then tie into a global problem that doesn't just affect its own people, but that could reach out and affect us as well.
All right, let's go to another caller. Bloomington, Indiana, our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
About Sudan, I would like to ask about several examples of Muslim aggression against Christians, both in Sudan and also in Indonesia. Sudan first, you've been talking about the Sudan. I understand well over 1,000 Christian churches have been burned. They just burn them to the ground. I guess it's true that in the South, the Christians in the South are mostly black, aren't they? And in the North, they're Arab. Is that right?
Well, yes, more than 1,000 churches have been burned in Sudan, and the number of mosques that have been burned is huge as well. What the government of Sudan has done is to use its form of Islam to attack Muslims and Christians alike who don't adhere to its particular principles. So it's not that this is a war between Muslims and Christians. And that's very, very important to understand that the South, okay, so northern Sudan, So Sudan is Africa's largest country. It's the largest country on the continent. It's about 1 million square miles. The north is predominantly Arab and Muslim, yes. Its south is Christian, yes, but its south is also made up of traditional believers, which means people who worship animals, land, sky, their own ancestors. You know, what we would have called pagans maybe 100 years ago, we now understand in a much more equitable context to be traditional believers. So the South has both of these kind of people as well as Muslims. And yeah, the government has used Islam to do exactly what it wants, mostly to get its right to oil. But we need to be careful to understand that it's not a war between Muslims and Christians. It's a lot more varied and a lot more intricate than that.
Yeah, I understand. You don't have to be a Christian. If you're just the wrong type of Muslim, they will
attack you.
That's what I understand in Indonesia.
Yeah.
Where they have a practice, the Muslims will have roadblocks. If you get stopped by one of these roadblocks, if you're either a Christian or the wrong kind of Muslim, they'll rob you. They may kill you.
Okay, so Indonesia, not quite that way. Indonesia, world's largest Muslim country, 240 million people. 9 out of 10 of them are Muslim. Also, the largest Muslim democracy in the world. And what's happened there is pretty heartening, and I think we can see that beginning to happen in other areas of the world. The kind of political Islam that is exclusivist, that is dangerous to those who don't follow it, is not super popular in Indonesia. In fact, its most violent manifestations are dying out. And what's happening is that the silent majority we're always talking about, well, why doesn't the silent majority of moderate Muslims, why don't they push back? They have in Indonesia, and they have turned to these radicals and said, guess what, you guys, you don't own our right to speak of God. You are not the true form of believers. And that's pretty heartening, because that's, again, points to these divisions within faiths that are, in fact, more important than any other to shaping the future of the world's religions. There has been violence between Christians and Muslims in Indonesia, particularly in the east of the archipelago. you know, and we have seen the kind of roadblocks you're talking about don't really exist anymore. That in small, isolated pockets, Christians and Muslims have really, really unleashed massive bloodshed against each other. We're not seeing that now. One of the odd patterns in which I've certainly seen between the equator and the 10th parallel, where these two religions meet, is, and for everybody from Nigerians to Indonesians will tell you this themselves, numbers games. Where democracy is new, numbers of believers, religion comes in as a particularly kind of problem because you want to, in a new democracy, you want to shore up numbers. And when religion and numbers and religion and democracy become ready fuel for each other, that's where the problem lies. But I wouldn't want anybody to go away following horror stories of what's going on in Indonesia, because the truth is that what we're seeing there is really progressive patterns that are much more heartening than any kind of isolated attacks against Christians, which are in fact dying out.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for his questions. We're getting into about our last 10 minutes here, and I've got some other people. I guess I just think it's worth reinforcing. I think what you've just said there is that in a lot of these places where there have been conflicts, these are places where there is and has been rapid population growth. So that's an issue, and also rapid growth in religious activity, and that I'm sure that has something to do with missionary work that's been undertaken by Christians.
You mean that rapid growth of Christianity?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. One of the in Africa, in both along the 10th parallel. This is historically the southern edge of the Muslim world. Right. This is what Samuel Huntington would have called Islam's bloody borders. I do not, and I started the book from a point of view of thinking, look, this clash of civilizations narrative, Samuel Huntington being the father of that clash of civilizations theory, is too simple. Let's look at what actually happens on the ground, right, along these bloody borders. The history is that in both Africa and Asia, when Muslim governments or Muslim powers were very strong in these areas along these borders, many of the people who were not Muslims were historically enslaved by Muslim slave traders. So in Africa, especially, we look in Nigeria, look in Sudan. This is the land. Sudan means Balada Sudan. It means the land of the blacks. Along the 10th parallel, historically, is where the world, where this African Black African world begins, right? This is where two kinds of wind and weather meet. This is the southern edge of Africa's dry north and the beginning of the wetter jungle south. And where those two kinds of lands meet, Islam largely stopped its southern spread. Because Islam spread over the northernmost third of Africa up through the 1800s. When Muslim traders and missionaries reached that southern edge, reached the 10th parallel, they had to stop. Why? Because where the jungle began, so did tsetse flies. And tsetse flies killed off their horses and camels. And so the traders and missionaries who were Islamic could go no further. When the European colonial powers came into Africa and began to scramble for Africa, scramble for its resources, missionaries came along with them. Missionaries had all kinds of intentions, they were bringing with them the two Bs, the Bible and the bicycle. Missionaries, in many cases, had absolutely no interest in combating Islam. They were just doing their own work. In some cases, they did. In some cases, they saw Islam as a rival monotheism, as something to be stopped from winning Africa and winning Asia, because the pattern's a little bit different. Same thing happened in Southeast Asia. So they targeted these minority communities that had long been enslaved by their Muslim neighbors, and they said, you know what, here's a rival worldview. Here's a rival globalization that essentially will keep you safe. Follow the Bible. You now are part of a huge power that will keep you safe against Islam. That's certainly true in Africa. These communities are some of the most violent today. These Christian communities directly believe themselves to be Christian soldiers coming out of that historic tradition. And in Southeast Asia, where the pattern was different, where on these islands, Islam had long won the coast by the time that missionaries targeted inland, the inland coastal divides, the pattern looks like bullseyes. Christian centers to islands, Muslim coasts, same kind of divisions. We are a Christian enclave, and we need to defend ourselves against the inroads Islam is making. Same is true in Islam. We are a Muslim enclave. We need to protect ourselves against the Christian colonial West, Christian post-colonial imperialism, and keep our values safe. It's when either of those populations believe themselves to be embattled, under threat, that they turn to religion as a source of self-protection and a source of religion as for conflict as well.
Another caller here, Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I really appreciate the author's concentration on the local dimension of things, and I think it's very important. I was trying to think of at least one example in that, and it's probably someplace you went, which is the particularity of the Moroccan grievance against Spain that people don't think about. But on Sudan, it seems to me the categories are very, very complicated. There was an implication in the previous caller that the Arabs were not black. I mean, that's not true particularly. The categories nomadic and sedentary is perhaps a more important division, and the climate change dimension rarely gets repeated regarding Sudan as well. But there are some international things and globalizing phenomena that are happening, and I have been persuaded that the global reach of fundamentalist Christianity is something that needs to be reckoned with, too, in stirring the pot. I think of an example, an allegation that senators take junkets right-wing. Coburn is denying that he was ever in Lebanon, apparently, but he's been taking his message of Christ as the solution to the Middle East conflict in very bizarre ways. It needs to be unpacked, and there's very little time to do it right here, but... but I also think of the Sudan, going back there for a moment, the mercenary group Blackwater was actually hired in some capacity, whether it was several times removed from American clandestine money, I don't know, to train these Christian soldiers in the south. At one point they offered, I don't know, I'll let you unpack a little bit of that, but I realize time's short. Thanks. But I think there's a whole other dimension that needs to be brought out of the shadows and find out whether how much is really there or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would really point you to the 10th parallel on this, because one of my efforts, beyond all else, you know, I started the book with the question, does fundamentalism of any stripe inherently lead to violence? Because it's about a binary division, saying that I am saved and you are damned. You are a sinner at best and you are evil at worst. And does that inherently lead to violence because of the divisions it sets up between people, whether those fundamentalists are Christians or whether they're Muslims? The answer is complicated, and I'm going to refer to you the book on it, because, again, it moves across, you know, 9,000 miles of asking these questions. There's no question that the role of conservative fundamentalist Christians in the United States going abroad as tacit or explicit emissaries of U.S. foreign policy is problematic and has been. And again, you know, I traveled to Northern Sudan with Franklin Graham, Billy's son and head of about $500 million evangelical empire. Fascinating man. He was going to the North for the first time to meet with President Bashir, who's still the president of Sudan today, although he's been indicted for crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. These two men both are self-avowed fundamentalists. They believe in two distinctly different worldviews, and to sit down with them and watch what unfolded was one of the most fascinating experiences I've had in my life, and I write about it in detail in the book. So to the point that foreign evangelists can stir up trouble, whether those evangelists work within an Islamic context, which is called da'wah, or within a Christian one, yes, that is extremely important to look at the role that they play in local conflicts and in informing local opinions of global matters, whether that matter is the war in Afghanistan or whether it's homosexuality.
And we're coming down to about 5 minutes, so unfortunately our time is limited. But just to hang there with the meeting between Franklin Graham and Omar al-Bashir, two things, I guess, that are really striking about it. One is I think that these two men maybe somewhere at some level were trying to convert each other. But the other thing is that you cannot split off their conversation, their meeting, from global politics. And as far as Franklin Graham was concerned, with American politics, you know, this is the point when George Bush was president of the United States, it gets one thinking about how the colonial experience then and global politics now helps to, I think, probably make these kind of conflicts worse.
Without a question. And not on some level were the men trying to convert each other. I watched them try to convert each other.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened in the palace in Khartoum. And then the meeting switched a little bit. And, you know, Graham reached into his pocket and handed Bashir a W-2004 reelection pin because George W. Bush was running for reelection at the time. And that visit coordinated with the White House? Not explicitly. Did it seem to have dimensions that were about faith and foreign policy? Without question. And those are the very kind of interactions that we need to ask about. We need to understand more for transparency in our foreign policy and the role that religion plays in it.
Yeah. And also, just for a minute, to come back to something that you touched on earlier, because I made a note of it, and I think that some people might have said, well, wait a minute, what do you mean by that? That is the connection between religion and climate change.
Mm-hmm. Religion and climate change is one of the most under-investigated, interlinked causes of conflict in the world. We see this explicitly in Sudan. We see it in Nigeria. We see it in Somalia and neighboring Ethiopia. What happens is, and I'm going to leave this really short and just point you to the book,
sure,
because it's a long, complicated story that's very, very important. This zone around the 10th parallel is one of the most environmentally compromised and sensitive in the world. It's here where these two kinds of land meet, the two kinds of wind and weather meet as well. It's here along the equator, along the 10th parallel, that the storms are generated that create America's hurricanes. They spin off the west coast of Africa, they hurtle over the Atlantic Ocean, and they strike America's east coast as hurricanes. So this is generated, this is a problem made worse by the climate change that we're seeing. And on the ground, what it means is that Christians and Muslims who meet in these areas, Muslims predominantly in the north, moving south, trying to find land where their cattle, because many are nomads, can eat grass that still exists. They run into settlers. They run into Christian populations that already have established farms along this fault line. What happens? The two clash over competing uses of land, and as a result, it looks like a religious war, but it begins in a fight over land. We see that in Darfur as Muslim, and we see it in Sudan, and we see it as one of the principal elements in what may be a return to one of the world's worst civil wars in history, and that's something we really have to pay attention to.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly when you try to take a look at the kind of conflicts that we're talking about and their roots and the things that tend to all come together to create these conflicts. And then you ask this question, well, if you're looking for a trend, do you think that things are going to get worse? Do you think that things are going to get better? It's kind of hard to not say, well, actually, it kind of looks like where's the potential? That the potential seems to be more for them to get worse.
You know, I try not to get into speculation, right, because I'm a reporter. I'll tell you what I see and how it is today, what people say, but I'm not going to try to trump up tomorrow.
Sure. No, I understand.
Yeah. But, you know, it unless we pay a more serious bit of attention to the role religion plays in small-scale conflicts very far away, we are going to miss one of the largest global fuels of trouble coming right back at us. The world and its people are interlinked. That's the basic truth of human existence. You can look at the weather. You can look at religion. You can look at radio waves. We can no longer abdicate our responsibility for those who live far from us, thinking, well, you know what? It ain't going to blow back on us. We only need to look at what happens when, say, a cuckoo holds up a Quran in Florida, says he's going to burn it, and guess what? People die in Afghanistan, and those very people who die in Afghanistan make tons of terrorists who want to come kill us. So, you know, this is a cycle, and if we don't start looking to how to break it far away, we're going to see it come home to us for a very long time.
Yeah. And maybe one other thing, I guess if you make the argument that one of the things that you can do to reduce conflict is to do what you can to improve the lives of people in places like this, what's sort of distressing is it seems like nowadays that non-governmental humanitarian organizations for people who do that kind of work, that's becoming one of the most dangerous occupations that there is. Because in conflicts like as we were talking about, these people have actually been targeted.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for most of the world's Muslims, we wonder, well, how do they see the West as Christian? We're so much more than Christian. Until very recently, all aid and relief work was a Christian enterprise. Missionaries did it. The UN is new. You know, Human Rights Watch, new. These are not organizations that have been around for 100 years reaching out to the world's Muslims. Christians have done that. You know, the precursor to the Muslim Brotherhood, the Young Men's Muslim Association, was directly founded as a counterpart and to combat the presence of the Young Men's Christian Association, the YMCA in Egypt. You know, the Young Men's Muslim Association taught health, hygiene, and scripture, the Quran, because it was afraid of the impact of Christianity in the Muslim world. These are the historical trends we have to understand why people are so threatened by the West today. And, you know, that is absolutely key. You know, what most of the world's Muslims see of the West is this missionary history, soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and yes, Britney Spears. That's what the West looks like. And we think, well, that's awfully reductive. What do we see of Islam? If somebody doesn't answer with Osama bin Laden as the primary source of Islam in the world, I'd be very surprised. That is the most vocal and radical and soundbited global presence of Islam we have. And so we need to look a little bit deeper into what do 4 out of 5 of these faces actually look like.
Our guest this morning, Eliza Griswold. She's a journalist, a fellow at the New America Foundation. She's written for a number of different publications. I've mentioned The Atlantic, New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, Harper's. And her book is The 10th Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam. Farah Straus and Giroux is the publisher. And Ms. Griswold, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Planned Parenthood of Illinois, where a current challenge grant for expansion of the Champaign Health Center is now in progress. More information is at ppil.org/champaign or at 217-359-9616.
Hi, I'm Jim Meadows.
I'm Tom Rogers.
I'm Sean Powers.
And I'm Celeste Quinn. You listen to us on WILL Radio and TV, and now we want to listen to you. Every month, we're out in the community having conversations about your hopes and challenges. What we hear impacts the programs we produce. If you'd like to have a community conversation in your town, give us a call at 217-333-7300 or email willconnect@illinois.edu.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. We're online at will.illinois.edu. A minute and a half before noon, 45 degrees in Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Jason Croft is our technical director. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 844, down 13 and three quarters. May 853, down 13 and a half. In Chicago, the March wheat contract is down 17 at 782 and a quarter. May 807 and three quarters, down 18. March corn, 615 and a half, down 8.5. May, 623 and three quarters, down 8.25. July, 627, down 8.75. September, 582 and a quarter, down 4.75. January soybeans, 1361 and a quarter, down 4.75. March, 1372, down 5. May, 1378, down 6. July, 1381 and a half, down 5. And August, 1353, down 3.75. January meal, 364 even, down 170. January oil, 56.35, down 3. December live cattle, 106.55, up 22.5. February, 107.70, down 55. January feeder cattle, 121.30, up 45. March, 123.65, down 42.5. And February lean hog, 79.05. They are down 55 cents. February crude, 89.23. Make that 89.21, down 191.